I do not know when the notices were finally out, but it was my understanding that you had to first get approval of you got approval on Friday, so you were only able to show money.
Yes.
Welcome. Welcome, Mr. Singh. Actually, I must start by apologizing that my clock is running a bit slow this morning, partly because you would have noticed that over the weekend there was articles relating to this report from the AG's office, which I spent some time talking to a few people, bouncing ideas around whether it had anything to do with us, in other words, whether we had any role to play in relation to it, in one form or another. And I thought that was one of the additional agenda items that I wanted to include this morning with your permission. Talking of which, I assume that everybody received a notice that contains a proposed agenda. I met with a smaller team last week Wednesday, including a representation from the AG's office, primarily to look at an initial program that we could put forward for consideration by the committee. You would notice that one of the documents in your file is this document, which is a draft program of activities that are already scheduled that are not confined between ourselves and the AG's office, that involve other organizations. So the idea was to say, as a committee, we shouldn't wait until the 1st and the 5th of August when we would formally have this introduction to the AG's office and so on, as the introduction happens to the other sectors. But that we actually should rather have a meeting at the earliest opportunity so that we can look at, you know, get to meet for the first time as a committee and look at what is before us, how best to engage with the work before us, understand what our role is, etc., before we can even engage in a more broader forum where the other players are involved. So it is in that spirit that we convened this meeting. And as I said earlier, we took a decision last week Wednesday, and the committee section had to obtain approval for us to speak, which was obtained on Friday, and hence the short notice which came out yesterday. So it's a long and winded way of saying sorry for the short notice. Right. Now, the proposed agenda for this morning is we propose that we deal with the introduction by the AG REMCO and Audit Committee. We understand that those are the substructures under the AG's office, so we felt that it would be good if they could come and be represented here so that they can introduce themselves as well to the committee. We will then deal with a brief introduction of the, you know, just to give a background to what this committee is about, how it came about, etc. I had requested Honorable Gumede, who was whip of this committee in the last parliament, sure if he was aware of Scott as well, and apparently has quite some experience regarding the background to the establishment of this committee. He said he would make himself available. I left a message in his cell yesterday again, and I'm not sure if we could get somebody to just follow up and see if during the current of the meeting we might not still get hold of him, because he seems to be keen to come and share 10 minutes of institutional memory with us. And then a brief discussion on the strategic role of our committee. We thought we could take a discussion amongst ourselves. In this regard, you would notice that there's some documents that attached to file. One is the report of the Standing Committee on the Auditor General Third Parliament. It's supposed to be a so-called legacy report. I don't know if everybody has a copy of that. Fairly short, it doesn't have much flesh to it. One of the things it does is that it provides us with a list of the functions of the committee, which in a sense define our mandate, probably drawn from both the Constitution, the Audit Act, and the rules. And then there's also linked to that another document. What is this one called? So this is just the summary of the constitutional and legislative prescripts that govern the establishment and function of this committee. So those are fairly short documents that you can look at, and that should inform our discussion regarding our role. And then we thought that having discussed our own specific role as we understand it, we may need to look at strategically how do we characterize our relationship with the Auditor General and the other substructures under the Auditor General. This is not intended to be an exhaustive exercise, bearing in mind that we still have scheduled for the 5th and the 6th of August a broader workshop where we will be participating together with COPA, together with the other structures in a formal introduction to the AG process. But these are just things that can keep us going in the meantime, because if work comes our way, we can't say we're waiting until August, you know. And then just general discussion. Program for the year, we thought that we would look at the draft program here and look at whether it is an adequate reflection of the full activities that we ourselves would want to be involved with, or whether in addition to what is contained here, we would want to plan other activities of the committee itself, including today's meeting, for example. So that's it. I don't know if the two items, a plan of action of the committee and a budget to support it, are things that we would be required by Parliament to develop in the House soon. We would require to do that in order to solicit funding for the activities of the committee. But I thought that's something that we need to put on the table and see how the committee actually gets But those are the items. And then I saw that over and above the draft program that I've put here, we should add I understand that Remco could not make the remuneration committee that determines the remuneration for the auditor general's office, where he invited them specifically to be here. So, right. Now, I thought that the additional item based on the weekend report that we would add would be the report of the auditor general on the summarized version of it, on the performance. Let's just say on tenders in the public sector, the involvement of public servants in tenders in the public sector. I think that's my feeble attempt at summarizing the long name that it has. Right. Now you also have the annual report 2007 to 2008 of the AG. I do not know whether Parliament has already considered the report as per the previous committee, and that aspect has been disposed of or not. But we'll get that from the Auditor General's office. And then finally, the budget and strategic plan of the Auditor General for 2009 to 2012. They probably will touch on that as well as they give us a brief input. Right, that is the long and winded explanation of the draft agenda before us. I don't know if there are any comments, any additions, subtractions to the proposed agenda as it stands.
Jefferson, thank you very much. This is my first meeting, so just forgive me if I talk about one thing. I think it's the first meeting for the colleagues. I see one of the challenges listed here, and the Deputy Auditor General is here, so it's actually fleshing out the role of this committee vis-a-vis the COPA and I see finance here, and particularly for smaller parties like myself. They are calling me desperately now from SOPA to be dead, because I'm on SOPA and I'm on this.
Yeah.
I think maybe at some stage, I see they don't meet very often, but from what I've read here now, my understanding is that this committee deals with the office of the Auditor General,
yeah,
and SOPA deals with the work that is produced by the Auditor General.
Yeah.
So the report that you referred to, Chair, with regard to the tenders and things like that would probably be under the purview of SOPA and not here.
Can we propose that you make that motivation when that agenda item comes? So that let's just put the letter on the agenda, and what we decide about would include based on the input that you have given. So let's hear all the views. There may be other views on that, but let's get to it when we get to it. And I think after we have gone through the other items, we'll be in a better place and position to make that assessment and to arrive at it. So that's what I'll propose, if you're comfortable with that. Alright? Okay, on that note, can we proceed with the agenda, and we therefore would proceed to deal with the first item, which is the first item, which is the AG's introduction.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you very much, committee members, for allowing us this opportunity to firstly, the Auditor General is going to be apologies for not being able to attend today's meeting. He's busy in the province on the municipality audit. He's busy visiting all the municipalities within the Western Cape province. And today he's down in the West Coast, and we are going to react arranged to be able to come today. but he has asked us to attend today. My name is Kimi Makoito, the Deputy Auditor General. And I will try as far as possible to represent the AG and the office today in terms of the discussions that are going to take place in the committee. Left hand side is Mr. John Binman Simon. He is one of the audit committee members of the Auditor General. He has kindly accepted to be with us today as well as in the absence of the chair of the audit committee, Mr. Peter Marlow. As was indicated earlier, none of the remuneration committee members were able to attend, and I suspect that it was to do with the fact that we were only informed towards the end of last week, and many of them are involved in a number of other businesses. They are non-executive members of our remuneration committee, so they felt that at the next opportunity they will certainly want to engage with the committee. However, if there are any matters pertaining to how that committee operates, I guess from the point of view of the details of how the regulation committee operates, it can deal with some of the issues, but I'm sure when the time comes for them to engage with the committee, we'll get more elaborative answers from them. And then Mr. CSC Felipe is the senior manager within the office of the Deputy AG, and he is also part of our delegation today. So, Chair, that's basically the introduction, and Mr. John Dillon Simmons obviously will talk to some of the detail around the audit committee, so of the committee members get in from how that audit committee operates in relation to the audit committee, the audit general. And from my side, I will be able to then handle quite a lot of the other issues pertaining to the office in general. Thank you very much, Chair.
Right, thank you. I think that perhaps what we can then proceed to deal with is speak to yourself from the Auditor General's office to then just talk briefly about the role of the Auditor General, how you operate, and also possibly to look at how you see the relationship between yourself and the committee based on the short stint of the existence of this committee as far, etc. And to the first item and to proceed.
Okay. First up to get the start of check, we will be putting together a comprehensive presentation for the orientation that we are planning to have with the committee on the 5th and 6th of August. Today we haven't gone around to put together a presentation, but I will be able to deal with a lot of the issues around the operations of the office. But more details, as I say, will come in August. First, let us have a start, Chair. In terms of the provision of what is in the Constitution, I'm sure committee members are aware that the office of the AG is set up as a result of a clause in chapter 9 of the Constitution, and it has been set up through a public audit act that was promulgated in Parliament. And the Auditor General, as a person, was appointed by the third Parliament, and is still operating in that capacity for a period of 30 years, but is not renewable. And the Auditor General, in order for him to execute the mandate as prescribed in the Public Audit Act, is also charged through the Public Audit Act to set up an office, which in this case is in existence in all the 9 provinces throughout the country, with the head office based in Pretoria. Now, the day-to-day activities of that office are under the full control and management of the Auditor General, and a number of activities that arise from the work that we do are delegated by the Auditor General. But primarily, the Auditor General in his person almost operates as a board, as a unitary board that has been appointed in Parliament. One of the mechanisms that has been developed within the Public Office Act is a mechanism which has been clearly defined as a standing committee on the Auditor General of this committee, whose responsibility, among others, is to protect the independence of the Office of the Auditor General and ensure that the Auditor General operates in accordance with its mandate. Now, in order for us to get to engage with the committee on an annual basis, we put together a plan for the next 5 years, which then gets submitted to the Standing Committee on the AG for them to look at to see whether that plan articulates the mandate that has been given to the AG for the public auditors. And we, on an annual basis, around September, submit that plan to this committee. As the chair has asked earlier, the one that we have in front of you was discussed and will see in the leadership document, which is in the file here. It was specifically engaged with by the Standing Committee on the Region in the third parliament, I think in October or November of last year. So on an annual basis, anything that we plan to do, whether it is to do with the development of policy standards that we believe are appropriate for us to be able to do the audit work that we do throughout all the state entities as well as the state departments, that plan is normally put forward to this committee to look at so that the committee can evaluate it to assess whether it is likely to achieve what the mandate of the AG's office is about. Now, coming back to the specific work that we do as an office, you will be aware that the law prescribes that the audit office, the Auditor General, shall audit all entities that are funded through the National Revenue Fund. That is all state departments, national, all departments within provinces, and all municipalities, all 283 of them throughout the country, are audited directly by the forces of the AG. And in certain instances, we also outsource that work to audit firms that are operating privately because of capacity issues. I'm sure we'll go into the detail of that in a minute. Now, the AG, as I indicated earlier, has got a responsibility to set up structures to be able to execute this mandate. All 35 or so national departments, all 9 provinces and the departments that belong to them, all public entities that are operating within the context of the administration of the state, as well as all municipalities and their public entities. The reports that we issue on an annual basis are issued through all the 9 provinces where we exist. Currently, the staff of our office is somewhere in the region of about 2,300 people spread across the whole of South Africa, with the head office in Pretoria, which is responsible for all the national departments in Pretoria. As I said earlier, because we are short on the ground in relation to our staff level, if one looks at the number of entities that we do audit, there's quite a lot of work that needs to be done which we are not able to do ourselves alone. So a portion of the work that we do, we also outsource to send out to operating in the South African environment. And those will include the likes of PricewaterhouseCoopers, Deloitte, Ernst & Young, and many others that are medium-sized and small auditing firms spread throughout the provinces. So that enables us then to be able to say that by the end of the financial year, which is 31 March, we will be able to issue all the reports timely. And I think it's important because the public, the Finance Management Act, the PFMA, prescribes that by the end of July, all the state departments and entities that have a financial year end of 31 March, we need to be signing off on the audit report by the at least 4 months after the end of the financial year. By the end of July, we should be signing off on all the reports. Now, for us to be able to do that, because of the capacity constraints that we have as an office, we then give some of the work to the firm to assist us to meet that deadline. That's the one level of work that we do. And this work that we do within the National Department has got everything to do with the funding that has been appropriated through Parliament. That's what we want to do. We are required to audit anything that is funded through the appropriation through Parliament. And secondly, as you'll be aware, the financial year end for municipalities in South Africa across the board, all 283 of them, their financial year end is the end of June. So immediately when we finish auditing the PFMA, we then have to immediately move into auditing municipalities. So our schedule on an annual basis is basically auditing throughout. But in addition to that, we also have a mandate in terms of the auditors.
Just to confirm, you refer to PFMA, which presupposes that the municipalities operate under a different statutory arrangement in terms of the financial accountability.
Yes. And that one is the MFMA, the Municipal Finance Management Act.
You know that Parliament recently has passed its own act, so we would also have our own regime that governs us. Are you going to be playing any role in that as well?
In relation to the Audit of Parliament?
Of Parliament in terms of the new legislative arrangement that Parliament has adopted.
Yes, certainly we will be involved in that. We haven't really gone into any detailed discussions about how we will be involved in the new
So essentially, in terms of statutory arrangements, we're talking of three key legislative regimes: the PFMA, the Minister of Financing, as well as the now the latest parliamentary regulatory framework. Right. Okay.
That's one other element on the part of the financial audit, which is the regularity of it. We also have a mandate to audit some of the institutions of the United Nations based in New York. We have a team, not a very big team, but we have an office that operates out of New York. And we audit many of the peacekeeping operations of the United Nations and some of the humanitarian projects that are driven by the UN. The appointment is an appointment that is running for a fixed period. We started getting involved with the audit of the UN around, I think, 2002, and the mandate is going to expire in 2012. We do that audit of the UN institutions together with France and China. And the rotation of the audit work that we get involved with. So when our mandate expires, obviously there will be another country that gets picked up to replace us when our term comes to an end. So that's the level of involvement required.
Would that be in terms of an international agreement of the UN Convention? How is that regulation, the mandate?
The mandate, when it goes back to 1948, I guess it was probably one of those arrangements that were set up subsequent to
set up
the
UN.
And since then, over the years, every country that is a member of the United Nations family has an opportunity to be part of the panel of the UN Board of Auditors, where they are given specific entities to audit. For example, the International Labour Organization will be one of the institutions that are audited by a number of countries, either Canada or any of them. The World Health Organization was one of our assignments that we did a number of years ago. We are now part of an audit predominantly of the peacekeeping operation. So the way that it's basically rotated through all the countries, but it's based on assessing the ability of that country to execute that task in relation to the financial arrangements that are prescribed by the United Nations itself. So it draws its prescript from international financial reporting standards, which those bodies need to comply with, and the rules and regulations governing the administration of finances as well as the auditing of those finances determined primarily by the General Assembly of the United Nations.
So it's more an affirmation of the contribution, the role that we can play on an international stage.
Absolutely. And when we teach for that type of work, we normally work very closely with what is now called international relations, because they are the people that are in the General Assembly who assist us in getting the necessary laws.
All right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's as far as the regularity of it is concerned. We also has started looking at the area of performance auditing as an office. the area of performance auditing has arisen as a result of the need to position auditing in respect of related issues. We identified, for example, in our, if you look at our college plan, which kicks in from April of this year, we've identified three areas for performance auditing that we believe we can have the union as an office. One of them, for example, is a topic around doing an assessment from a performance auditing point of view on the utilization of consulting services within the broader sphere of government. another topic that we've also fixed to bring in this period for the next 5 years, the whole area of assessing the effectiveness of oversight and governance over public entities by state departments. For example, in the instance of public enterprises, for example, the department where there's a number of entities that fall under them, we would want to do a performance audit to assess whether public enterprises as a department has the necessary tools and abilities to exercise oversight over the entities that it controls.
Mm.
The same thing with communication departments and many other departments throughout which they are public entities. So that's the one area of focus. We're busy in the process of developing the methodology and the approach to handle that area.
You may be interested, storage colleagues were finding in constantly, that in my previous life, when I was chairing social development, there is a public entity, SAC, and we had an extensive debate on the relationship between SASA as a public entity and the department and the oversight function that the department should play. And there was an element of resistance where SASA felt, in terms of the legal arrangement, it reports directly to the minister. And we had a debate as to what is the full definition of the concept of minister, where we argued with the committee that the minister should include all the generals that he uses to enhance his capacity to discharge his executive functions, and therefore his DG and all his senior managers who have some direct role in this should actually assist him in holding that particular entity accountable. But certainly my attitude was, if that institution fails, I'm not only going to call SASA and ask them why they failed, but I'm going to call the department itself, and I told them up front, I don't buy this excuse that you say SASA wants to be independent, it doesn't want you to have any fiddling with the assets, you know. But yeah, I just find it interesting now that you raised it.
Yeah. And certainly, Chair, to just pick up on your point, in most of these departments, you will find that there is a shareholder context that exists between the department and
the entity.
And the entity. Where it prescribes that, for example, on a quarterly basis, we need to provide support and update on how they are executing the strategic plan that has been agreed with the shareholding department.
Mm-hmm.
So our approach really is to say, if there is a shareholder contest that sets out a government framework that needs to be put in place, our intervention is to say, to what extent is the department responding to its own expectations in terms of how it's going to manage what comes back from the entity, for example. Is it effective? Are there factors within the department that ensure that when a report is submitted from the public entity, which sets out all sorts of financial risks that have been highlighted by the public entity, is there a mechanism in place to ensure that the department is able to respond to those issues and also provide the necessary support that is required of the shareholder in a typical shareholding environment? So that's the type of area that we want to look at looking at, rather than going straight to the entity, looking at it from the point of view of the department that has appropriated funding for that particular entity. So we're still at the stage of developing this one. And the reason we try to confine our topic to specific topics is that in the past we've always done performance auditing based on a reactive approach, where we are informed that there is a particular issue pertaining to conflict of interest in a particular environment, and we run in and do that based on a response to our request. But instead, we believe based on the work we've done, there are certain areas that we can focus on proactively to ensure that it is in some level of comfort given to the system with regards to governance arrangements in the area of usage of consultants, in the area of management and public. And certainly the one that is, we've also picked as a topic, was to specifically look within the education environment. Start doing performance audits, focusing on issues of economy, effectiveness and efficiency. Those three things of performance auditing that we normally address. We know that within the education area, subsequent to the splitting of the higher education and the basic education department, we might still need to go back to the drawing board and look at what it is that we want to focus on specifically around the area of education. But those are the three areas from the performance auditing point of view that we will be focused on. Then the other third element that we also have legislative authority to deal with is the area of investigation. And this is really responding to any authorized person who requests us to do an investigation. For example, the matter we referred to earlier regarding what was in the Sunday Times report is a typical example of the type of work that we would do. We've done a number of investigations in quite a number of
years. It has been out of your own initiative, or was it actually a mandated investigation?
This one was a mandated investigation. So the three areas that we would then engage with FOEC on would be, firstly, beginning of the year, we would say, in order for us to execute our constitutional mandate from a regularity audit point of view, here are the prescribed auditing standards that we are going to use in order for us to achieve the objective of doing the audit. And we will present those standards to the committee, and the committee will engage with those standards to understand whether these standards are at the level that can give sufficient comfort to the system after an audit has been done. So that's really the level to which the committee will get involved in that, as well as on the performance auditing side. One of the discussions that we had with the previous committee, and I'm sure you will have with the committee last year, was to look at the difference between performance auditing and what is referred to as the audit of performance information. If, for example, social development was issuing grants to 10 million people, when they put that information in their annual report indicating the different categories of beneficiaries of social grants, what we will do with that information is put in the annual report, we will audit it from the point of view of accuracy. Is it generated from a system within social development that can be relied upon? Is it accurate that there are 10 million beneficiaries, for example, on the social grant system? And is that information positioned in such a way that it does not mislead a person reading the annual report on social development.
So what is the extent of that and effectively misleading Parliament? Because that would be contained in a report that is tabled with Parliament.
So that's the element of assessment of accuracy and validity of performance information that we would do. What is contained in the annual report? So when you look at the details, for example, of how many houses were delivered by human settlement, we would say that we have verified this and this information. We think that is generated from a credible system. That is for all the necessary security in it, so that nobody can go in and push in an additional 20 million units. So that's the level of waste. So it's more auditing that information rather than assessing it, whether it is effective or efficient. Whereas the performance audit is about looking at is this particular implementation of this policy achieving what was intended. So that's the difference. So we have that discussion with the committee, I'm sure, during the year as well in the orientation program.
In fact, I cannot already sense the itching in the palms of colleagues wanting to engage on some of these issues. But we'll just allow you to conclude on that.
But then coming to the staffing of the office, we have a scheme that's operating within the Auditor General, which basically is what we refer to in the public auditing environment as a training accountant scheme, where we take on graduates into our staff establishment, and many of them come in for a period of 3 years where they complete their articles, and many of them are pursuing the qualification of a chartered accountant. We have that scheme running in the office, and we've got about just around 700-800 people across the whole country who are graduates with commerce qualification, many of them who are pursuing the chartered accountancy profession, who are training for a period of care. And it helps us to deliver on this audit because it guarantees to a certain extent the availability of
the
manpower that we process for the rules. And in addition to that, we've obviously also got people who are permanently employed in the office. Many of them are employed on what is referred to as fixed term contracts, for example, where people are there for a 5 or 7 years. And others who were part of the establishment of the AG many years ago are on a permanent staff establishment without any fixed term. So there's a variety of options that are available from the staffing point of view. And because we know that the economy of what we do does not support a permanent establishment wherever body, because there are times in the year where we are not really finished with audit, and there are times when we are very busy. And that's where the issue of combining our own hours that we generate through the audit work that we do ourselves, combining it with the work that is done on our behalf by terms of audit. The structures that we have in place within the office, as you would have seen in our organogram in the strategic plan document, is obviously the Auditor General, and then his deputy. There's about 8 corporate executives who are the people responsible for the different portfolios that we audit. And most of those people who are doing and directing and leading the teams of auditors, they report to a person who is called the head of auditing, who is responsible overall for the entire portfolio of the audit work that we do. Many of the corporate executives, and many of them will be coming through to Parliament because we've got an engagement with COBA since next week, many of them have got portfolios that are a mix of national departments, provincial departments, and municipalities. And then it spreads into the various provinces. So once a person who is a corporate executive and head office has a portfolio, for example, the Eastern Cape, Free State, and 4 or 5 national departments, they then dish that work out to the person who is the head, what used to be called the provincial auditor many years ago. Those people are the people who are leading the teams of auditors in the provinces, and they are the key people that in the provinces and they issue MECs as well as for Crimea or for particular province in the context of the auditor committee. And then the rest of the staff who are then our field workers who are responsible for doing the auditor committee. That's the auditing side of things in short, and I'm going to, you're going to obviously elaborate on this one during the orientation. But also we've also built up over a number of years some corporate service structure, which range from the finance department, human capital, ICT, and various other roles, for example, that we find necessary in the office. Those ones again, we will give you a background to how those structures came about and what we have in place for them from the point of view of the financial commitment that we have. Now, going to the issue of the funding of the office, we are sitting in a peculiar situation in South Africa if one compares us to a lot of the other countries, auditors general, where our funding as an office is dependent on the auditees that we have. They are the ones who are supposed to approve
fees for service and records.
Yes. Whereas in our jurisdiction, the entire office of the AG is normally funded through the parliamentary system. So here we have the situation where we have to deal with services rendered, and sometimes we hit challenges, and of course, because there are much bigger challenges, which I guess we will engage with the committee in due course when we present our annual report. And the challenge that we face is to prove it, our ability to collect that cash.
We hire debt collectors. We issue a lot of common sense to
the country. And Mr. Simmons will deal with some of the aspects of that when we talk to the issue around the economy. In terms of the government structures in place within the office, there are quite a number of them, but the more important ones are the separate of the committee. As you know, that we have an audit committee, and I'm not going to go into any detail with Mr. Simmons for the presentation to deal with that. What about the Remuneration Committee? And if one looks at how most of these committees have been positioned, I'm just going to talk in general the principles that bring them apart. Because of the emphasis on the independence of the AG, a lot of these committees do not have fiduciary responsibility. So there's no board that they report to. So many of them are there to provide advice to the AG. They do not have the power to make decisions on behalf of the AG. The AG can decide whether, for example, if there's a proposition that comes from the office to say that payroll increases for this year must be X percent. That is an advice that the Remuneration Committee is giving to the AG. The AG can decide whether he wants to go along with that. So, and also of course the audit committee also for the similar kind of profile, I'm not sure the detail of that in here, but also the terms of reference of all of these committees have been established, and they are operating on a very clear set of terms of reference in terms of what it is that we are allowed to do, what our authority is, and what it is that we are not requested or expected to do. And in addition to that, we've also, because of the critical...
And that includes REMCO, which determines the salary of the AG. It's an advisory body, it's not a statutory, constitutional, independent body of the AG.
But ultimately the advice that they will do, they will put together an advice working with our HR business executives, for example, in determining the AG salary in terms of his personal salary. It will be, the process will be an advice that is given by REMCO to SCOWEC. So it will be SCOWEC that would engage with that and look at it from its own statutory responsibility to decide, because the ultimate decision is then made by SCOWEC with respect to the AG's remuneration and program. But they will rely on the expert advice of those people.
I know Parliament determines the President's salary, but the Parliament salaries are determined by an independent body headed by a judge who then recommends to the President, and the President makes the determination.
Yes.
so but we'll come back to some of that.
Yeah, and then the other committee that we have, which I think is of interest also to the committee, is the Quality Control Assessment Committee. And that committee's job really on an annual basis is to look at the outcome of the quality that the office is providing with regards to adherence to auditing standards, with regards to sticking to the code of ethics, as well as the standards that are prescribed for the auditor general. And this committee is chaired by the AG, and is made of a number of people who are also outside independent people, where they assess whether we provide or those work or quality that can be relied upon. And that's really part of what is driven from the government point of view. Mr. Chair, I think what's going to be important now is to leave it at that and see if there are any further questions that will dig into some of this debate. But I'm sure that at the appropriate time, we have 2 days of this debate.
Yeah. No, I think we'll pause at that juncture. We'll come back to RAMCO and Audit Committee. I think I'd like at this juncture to give members an opportunity to engage with their input, which is quite extensive. Be it questions of clarity or certain comments that members would like to make in relation to their internalization of the issues that have arisen out of their input.
I'm
prompting you.
No, thank you very much. Just to thank the professor and colleagues for the and yourself. I think, as the deputy AG said, when we have this 5th and 6th session, and there's a clear understanding for me, in my own mind, of how we can operate within the bigger picture of things and what our specific roles are, and what the urgent requirements are of the Office of the Auditor General vis-à-vis the work of the committee, because I see there's some legislative amendments or something that have been proposed here, looking at another document. But one of the questions I'd like to ask generally is, you know, you say you short stop, and you sit on the ground, and you use PwC and all these other companies. The issue of conflict of interest. Because a number of these auditing firms also do audits for companies that deal with our public entities and deal with government as well, as service providers to government and to departments. How do you manage this conflict of interest thing? Because as a corporate company, I mean, they have a wing of theirs probably is dealing with something. Then secondly, what is your ideal staff? Have you given thought? What is your ideal staff complement? If you say, let's do away, because it's interesting you're doing performance auditing on consultants, but here you yourself are using consultants to assist you in your work. What is the ideal staff complement of the Office of the Auditor General where you wouldn't require outsourcing any of the work that you do? And then the third thing is you spoke about any authorized person can ask the Office of the AG to conduct any investigation. For example, the one on the 1061 and the one on the... Tender committees and things like that. Who is the authorized person? I mean, I haven't had a look at that. How would you define authorized person? And then lastly, is the link between internal audits within departments and yourself? Is there cooperation? Is there lots of talking to each other to prevent some of these things that go on in departments? Because basically, when we look at SCOPA, I mean, after the horse has bolted, then SCOPA takes the report, looks at it. And what I found quite disconcerting is, you know, when SCOPA presents a report to Parliament, I mean, you don't find any member of the executive sitting there. So you're talking to, you know, you're talking to 50 colleagues that probably remain to listen to a SCOPA report, and everybody else is gone home. So, I mean, what kind of control can there be, and how can the report of the Auditor General, which is supported by SCOPA, make members of the executive take action on heads of departments. Because a lot of them just come there, they listen and decide it comes out on that year, they carry on doing the same thing. How can we be more forceful in terms of, you know, measures that we can take against HODs and officials that transgress when they're dealing with their contracts?
Thank you. Any comments or
thank you. One of the good things is, after so many questions, some of them were reflecting on how I was going to ask. But I still have the question, and we are still addressing with understanding the whole thing. It's new to us. You say we actually ask questions, maybe that you are able to explain. I'd like to know about the entities. How often are they supposed to come to and report to me if they have to? And you talk about the staffing. You said you take graduates. Do you give them the training to do the exact job of the auditor in the okay, with the remuneration, I did not understand when it comes to the auditor general. Who defines the remuneration to the auditor?
In fact, one would expand the question you asked as to how often do the entities report to you, and link it to the point you made earlier that suggested that your activity is an event more than a process. Like much of the year, there might be very little activity. One would have thought the other way around, that wouldn't be appropriate, the ideal thing rather, have been that he audit almost every day, in the sense of having permanent presence, not so much to look for the officials to look behind their back every time they press a button of anything. But I've heard there's something called internal audit committees in the department, for example. To what extent would those, for example, be linked to your office? Because my worry has always been that this report comes a year and a half after the fact. By then, so much has changed. How effective could this be as tools to enable Parliament and its respective committees to hold departments accountable, assuming that your work ultimately is the most authentic and reliable tool that Parliament has to exercise its oversight function. But that is the, let's just take one or two more, and that would be the first round of questions. I think there might be quite an interest.
But I would like to ask from communication to the general, how long have we been as short staff? And then have you ever said to
how long have you been?
Short staff.
Oh, all right.
And also using the quota instead of having a full time and staff, the money you spend on quota then. Because of that, you'll also stop. And what are the people who are not being support staff? This is the question for me.
It's actually linked to the earlier question that Mr. Singh asked. I have a number of questions, but I'll reserve them for the next round.
Right. Let me start with the top one. You know, the one thing that we start from is that here we are dealing with a finite program. We know how many national departments are there at the time that we do the planning. we know how many departments in total that is within the province, and we know how many municipalities and their entities are there that need to be audited. What we then do, we say, based on our history and our experience of the risks that we need to be looking at in each of those establishments that we audit, it translates, and I'm going to use a number, generally the same number, it translates to, let's say, for the full financial year, it translates, let's say, to 4 million hours that are required in order for us to be able to get to a point where we finance on the entrepreneur. When we translate it to the 4 million hours, we then say, these 4 million hours, if they are to be spread across the different levels of people, starting from a training accountant who's in first year of articles, second year, third year, a manager, a senior manager, a business executive, and a corporate executive. How many people would we need to be able to audit the entire system? We can come to a number, and say that the ideal complement that is required for the auditor general is about to be able to do what is required in terms of the public audit set. Section 4.1, which talks about auditor general must audit and report on the account, financial statements, and financial management of all the entities that are listed, national, provincial, public entities, and all of that. It can easily translate to possibly a number more than double what we currently have. It could easily translate to that. If we were to say we're going to take everything and do it ourselves, can easily translate to what I said earlier, that we've got about 2,000 odd people. We could end up with a complement somewhere in the region of, let's say, 5,000 people. Now we then look at this and say, well, let's take the ideal situation. Maybe we can go find 5,000 people to audit throughout the year. Now the reality is going to be, if you bring them into our system, they are going to become a cost to us, even at times that they are not auditing. Because remember, the state is audited to one financial year, which is March, and municipalities in terms of the MFNA is audited to one financial year, which is June. So in between those periods, even though the audit is not just happening in the month, it's also happening in November, December, January, as a build-up, because some of the departments are big. So some of the audits start, let's say, in November, December, where they are doing the planning and the interim audit. And it can take in one department 4 months of presence of those people in that establishment. But there are situations where that in that 5,000 people you could find that, let's say, 1,500 of them are not utilized in order to be able to justify the cost that the office is carrying. So the office will still have to pay for their salaries on a monthly basis, whether or not they were sent out to an audit. We will still have to organize for accommodation to accommodate all of them, and we will still have to provide them with laptops and various other things that they need to be able to be ready to execute an audit. So we have said, rather than have that situation which will cost the state almost more than double what we currently have in our budget, let us rather combine our own resources with people who are running their own audit businesses out there, who will come in based on our instruction of what needs to be done, to say to them, please go and audit correctional services for us. But your auditing of correctional services is subject to our full control via our audit controller. So they don't go there and audit regardless of what we say. They take instructions from us. So effectively, this combination of outside firms, which we call consultants, and ourselves, is really a plan to try and manage the cost to the state, because the state could be paying quite an exorbitant amount of money for people who are not available every day to be utilized on audit. So the firm will say, we'll do this audit for you for the next 6 weeks. They've got their own establishment, their own office, their own staff. They send their people with a team of five, let's say, to a department to go and audit. And they finish that audit within the prescribed period at an agreed amount. And once they are finished,
then they are foreign, and we deal with our own people internally in our system. So that's the mechanism that is arrived at. It's not so much about a preference for consultants rather than using our people, but it's about the economics that drive our activities will not be able to support a few companies from a cost point of view.
But I think that the further point that Mr. Singh has raised, let me put it differently, doctors, before they start doing their work, they take this so-called oath of hypocrite. I don't know why, but hypocrite, for the background, hypocrite. But I don't know what oath the accountants take. As parliamentarians, we take an oath before the Chief Justice. But even then, we know that, as reports say, Enron possibly could have been averted if accountants did what they expected to do, or rather auditors. So even with professional ethics in place, which all of us should adhere to, we know that there's always a human factor. And the question really arises in the context of saying, how do you ensure that you manage the human factor element to the minimum in a situation where you have to ship out work to people who may have already a vested interest in the sense of receiving work from the very same entities that they control through audit? What are the checks and balances?
We do have that. Every firm that does audit work for us, we have the declaration of conflict of interest. And when we evaluate the work that we contract out, there are also checks and balances to check whether these people are doing consulting services in that department. Because if a firm is doing consulting services at health, for example, they are barred from doing consulting. Their conflicts. So effectively, if CWC was doing consulting services with local government, they wouldn't be awarded the service. So we've got those checks and balances. And also, in terms of their own people, we rely on their own risk management standards that they develop in their own firm. Because we know that they subscribe to a code of professional conduct and therefore risk management discipline within their institution. So part of this process of responding to the request for help, there's a whole suite of information that they need to provide, which we look at and assess to determine which ones are going to be able to go where to us in certain departments and which ones will not be allowed to. So there are those checks and balances. And
I don't know if Ms. Sebe wanted to make a follow up on this.
I just wanted to say this, Ms. Sebe, because I do understand. Maybe just some of us like me catch up when the time goes on.
Mm.
On the issue of this consulting, I'm still not convinced that even if you don't take these people as a full time staff, and I do understand the many issues pointed to that, I think the other thing is what we can do, because the rate of unemployment is very high, which is not also a single reason like that. If we have this pool of people, full of people from this one who are studying to their programs, maybe in your system you capture them, their programs, this is a good, maybe 50 or 500, not in your program. Where there's that time of auditing their programs, just take from them as casual, not permanent basis, because we already know that this school, we have trained them, they know the system, they know how we operate. Just have to take them and recommend them their system. Rather than taking the consultants, but if it's a consultant, to me, it's just few people will be benefiting out of that. But if you take
but this. I understood the minister's presentation to say that they tap from both streams, that in fact, already they have on their system something like 700 trainees that they're involving on the one level. But even that is not adequate, because my understanding would be that they set certain level of probing, which a beginner is not going to be able to do for you. So you're going to need tried and tested group in the industry when it comes to second level of work. And that's where the question then arises, you know, can they be self-sufficient with their own highly trained staff? Also, I think given the cost, you know, in the legal profession we have this problem that it's difficult to attract people to the judiciary because lawyers in private practice might make much more money than a government can ever pay them. Now, if you want people at the cutting edge of some of the things, you may find yourself in the dilemma that you can't attract in terms of the kind of money that they would be able to settle for at full time. I know I'm not supposed to answer for you, but I'm just facilitating the engagement as well. But I interrupted you. Do you want to take it further than the point you raised? Yeah.
So the DAG has asked me if I'd like to say anything. I think the it's not necessarily an issue that the audit committee has deliberated on, but in terms of my own background, I am a chartered accountant. I was a partner in one of the big four auditing firms. I worked for them for over 20 years, 13 years as a partner.
Mm-hmm.
The peaks and troughs in any business cycle make it very difficult to staff up for your peak period because of, as the DAG said, the cost of maintaining that staff.
Just like the farming industry.
Yes.
Like the farming
industry, if you're growing grapes, there's a harvest period for grapes. You can't hire a harvester for the whole year because the rest of the year he or she would sit without work to do. So I think that's a very important point that the DAG made. The other point that I think is worth considering is the private audit firms all have their rates of charge out, and each firm is entitled to set their own rate. In terms of the work that the audit general contracts out to private firms, they operate in terms of a lay down set of charge out rates. And those are at a significant discount to the rates that the private firms would charge their clients.
Mm.
So I think the Auditor General is doing what they can in that sphere to try and limit the cost of audits. But in the same way, you could ask, why are those private firms prepared to do work for the Auditor General at a lower rate? It's for the same reason, the peaks and troughs.
Mm.
If they can arrange to do a lot of that work
for country.
Yeah,
I think it's sentimental. But thanks, you've corrected me. There's a pecuniary gain.
There's
a financial rationality.
But I think it's worth noting, just to answer that that point, particularly the large audit firms take an immense degree of pride of work that they do. For example, if a firm can boast that they've audited greater percentage of the top 100 companies on the stock exchange, they're very proud of that. Equally, an auditing firm is very proud if they secure the audit of one of the metros, a very large municipality or something, because it's really an expression of faith in their ability by the Office of the Auditor General. So it's, you know, there are all sorts of reasons why they would take on the work, but certainly the peaks and troughs is a key issue, and I think financially, in terms of the budgets of the Auditor General, it makes sense for them to do that. I also know, because I was in charge of human resources of the firm I worked for, that the source of staff and adequately trained staff is extremely difficult to. There just is a dearth of skills. And while, as one of the members made the point that there is a high level of unemployment, it's not necessarily true within the accounting profession. So if the office were to go out and try and hire staff of their own, I think they would struggle to find the numbers of staff that they wanted.
Mm.
So I think for a number of pretty compelling reasons, certainly I personally would support the office's program. As I said, the audit committee hasn't really deliberated on this point in great detail, so I can't speak on behalf of the audit committee, but certainly as a as an experience part of the council, I would support their.
I just want to assure colleagues that my coming to in a sense to the rescue of the AG does not in any way suggest that I am limiting members' sense of wanting to hold the AG's office accountable on behalf of Parliament in relation to their performance. I noticed that, and this is the other issue I'm going to pursue later, that in our terms of reference, there's reference to us having to ensure the independence of the AG and related matters, but there is no reference, unless I didn't read the document in front of me correctly, to exercising oversight on the AG's office, the performance of the AG's office. And that's one other issue that I would want us to get to. Is it our role to do that under the Constitution, relevant legislation or not? Can that be interpreted to be detracting from our principal function of ensuring the independence of the AG by exercising oversight? Because some of these questions go to the question of precisely that question of whether we should be holding exercising oversight on the function of the AG as an office. But you wanted to make a follow-up?
I'm a little bit covered now. I'm sure we have to sit down and find out where we want. I was supposed to do
Now don't worry, we will get to that point where we will engage vigorously on some of those issues so that we can refine. You know, when you come to the point of engaging, and the idea is not to exhaust the space today, it's just to facilitate initial interaction, the first, if you like, encounter.
Or
all right. I see somebody showed me something. A general oversight requires in terms of section. All right, there were a number of other questions that may have not yet been responded to, so I would want to afford the AG's office an opportunity to finish the question, unless it's a follow-up on an existing
question. No, not follow-up. I see one of the instruments that the DAG is using is the Public Audit Act, and I think it might be useful if one of us are favored with the copy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, I think that...
And any other...
I think that one of the things we're going to do as a committee is to work out a full list of legal instruments that inform our work. I see there's a selective pointing out of certain provisions in the Constitution, for example, that inform our work, and I think we may need to do a full review of the range of prescripts in the Constitution that inform directly in the work we have to do. For example, Chapter 9 of the Constitution has a general provision which deals with Chapter 9 institutions generally. I think we need to examine that and say, obviously, there's something to the extent that Chapter 9 institutions relate to Parliament. For us to look at that, and a whole range of other areas within the Constitution itself, let alone other institutions. But for now, we're just scratching the surface, just to warm up ahead of our full, you know, exercise of getting to know better. Yeah.
That's a quick one. Responding to the question raised on investigation as to who is the authorized person. again, I mean, the board is taking authority from the FBI and pointing out, it says here that the Auditor General will consider an investigation upon the receipt of a complaint or request, but it doesn't specify in the FBI that must come from board. So I guess it would be basically, it would normally either be a member of the executive, for example, if there's something that is triggered from the FBI. So I think from our side also we are required to assess where that comes from. It can't just be taken from somebody who is unrelated to that institution. Otherwise, we spend time doing investigations every day.
You know, a whole lot of things are likely to arise in this context. For example, I know when I was with the Justice Committee, when we were drafting the whistleblower legislation, an ordinary employee in government was given a right to uncover any impropriety that may occur in the department, and certain protections were guaranteed for a certain provided that they followed certain channels. I'm not sure whether those channels would include, for example, reporting to the Auditor General, and if that were to happen, you know, would the Auditor General first have to make it a precondition that the report should come to them via some senior office within the department, or it would suffice for them to actually use whistleblowers directly to in the course of their own approach. I would imagine that given the report they produced, this report, they probably would have used whistleblowers to probe into some of the information that assisted them in unearthing some of the things that they are alluding to. But anyway, you can go ahead.
And then the question raised also, Chair, on the issue of internal audit departments and then on the relationship with them. Yes, we do. And that relationship takes a number of forms. During the course of an audit, we have what is put in place within every department what is called an audit steering committee. In that audit steering committee, you normally have the DG, you normally have internal audit, and various other players who have a direct interest or impact on the audit service go through the audit. But in addition to that, the work that internal auditors are doing, we do look at it. If, for example, internal audit has done work on the payroll of the department and they've come to a conclusion that the systems that are in place within the department are strong enough to be relied upon, we will look at that work as well and say, based on the work that internal auditors have done, we think that from our point of view, we need to do lesser work than we would have done had there been no internal audit. So we do have, in our report, when we issue our report, we specifically also mention situations and instances where we found the internal audit department not to be effective. We do report on that. Even in situations where the internal audit is not in place, we do report on that. So we do evaluate the strength of internal audit because we think that it provides additional control to the department and we don't necessarily ignore it. In all respects, we consider what they do. And then the point was raised around the frequency of reporting by these entities. I understood the question to be how frequently do you report to us? You report to us annually, because according to what we have to do with respect to the audit, we need to submit annual financial statements to us, and we need to audit those financial statements. So every year we have to audit them. So I think the one thing that I think has happened over the years since the TFNA and all other SA reports we talk about. The audit office in the past used to be a number of years behind with regards to the sign off of the audit. Now, I think in the higher 90%
on track with regards to the sign off of audit opinion from the State Department, from the provinces, and the municipalities. There are those exceptions where the accounting records in some places were in such a state that they were unauditable, even, for example, for 2005, 2006. But as I say, that is an exception. And I think what it says to us is that much of the fact that the audit is reporting on work that has happened in the last 12 months, I think the comfort that I think we are getting in doing this work is that from our side, we are able to issue a report in July of this year with respect to all activities that were undertaken by a department up to 31 March of this year. And I think that's very critical because from a governance and oversight point of view, it enables those that are charged with oversight to then act on the issues that we highlight in our report. It might look old, and of course it may well be that one comes after an event, and that's the nature of financial audit anywhere in the world. But the reality is that we are not auditing this year, 5 years ago, worth of activity. We are auditing the current period. The sign-off of the accounts, the 31 March accounts that were appropriated in Parliament 12 months ago. Now, the department have already spent that money up to the 31st of March. We are able to give a report 4 months later with respect to the current period. And I think that's a significant advance that has happened in the system, because in the past, you would know that there were many instances where some departments or some entities were 10 years behind on their auditing, which means that even if you found something today, you are dealing with something of 10 years ago. Whereas now we are at a situation where we are dealing with the current period, the expenditure that happened yesterday. But I think the issue about the fact that it comes up with the nature of auditing, it is unlikely to be done before the financial year. Staffing and training, the fundamental element of the kind of work that we provide, there's a very strong training element. And the training that we do is two levels. One is the training that we schedule ourselves, that we do as part of our training department that we have. We also train them on the job, because the requirement that is there for us in relation to the training contract that we enter into our training officers is that we must train them. We must expose them to systems of financial management and financial administration. We expose them to issues of governance and oversight as part of their training on the job. So the fact that they've got levels of people who have got the requisite experience and expertise above them provides that safety. To say that they are working with experienced auditors, many of whom have got a track record in doing the work that we do, when they come into our environment, they only come in there with the academic element after they finish their studies at the university, and they come and join us. And what we provide them is the day-to-day experience in terms of dealing with finance and financial matters. So there is a very strong training element, which is also supplemented by specific training interventions that we give our staff.
If I might add in something
yeah.
there as well, the office does have a staff bursary scheme and a staff loan to enable young aspirant chartered accountants to study through university, and they I think they should be saluted for the work that they do in that area. The office is a very well transformed organization. They have they've set up in the past targets in terms of previously disadvantaged individuals. They are well ahead of their targets with an impressive caliber of staff, and I don't think they would be able to do that if they were resting on their laurels in this area. And it's slightly out of context, but just to mention that there is, as I think your committee members may be aware, an independent regulatory board of auditors known as IRBA, set up by statute, and they have a system of peer reviews of the various auditing firms. The Auditor General asked IRBA to come in and do a review, and they got a review result that was on a par with most of the large firms in the country. So I think certainly as an audit committee member, I found it very impressive the effort that they've put into the training and development of their staff, that they are able to achieve an impressive IRBA review result in the context of being a significantly transformed organization. I think there should be some loot in that.
Thank you. Full range of questions. Yeah, all right. I have a few questions on the second round to kick start off with. The first one is this building on the issue around capacity building as such of public entities to, you know, in advance, you know, to ensure that you don't come after the fact with a cracking whip when you have not up front assisted in the building of the necessary capacity of government departments and other entities to effectively comply with the standards that you've set. Is it your role? Or is it somebody else's role? Or is it the responsibility of the entities themselves to familiarize themselves with they are a duty, and is that as far as you can take it, or can you do more than that? You mentioned, for example, that where audit committees are in place in departments, very often they have very little work to do. Why is it that there would then be entities that do not have those tools or those institutions? Who takes responsibility of making sure that it's a matter of course? A department is a complete department because partly it has a CFO, some of them don't even have CFO, but has an audit committee, has all the essential institutional arrangements that will ensure that a department is able to manage its resources with the necessary probity. The second issue is relating to enforcement. It's partly linked to the role of this committee, which is said to ensure the independence, protect the independence of yourself, I suppose vis-a-vis the world out there, but also vis-a-vis the parliament itself, by sensitizing parliament, as I understand it, to making sure. For example, when we get to the additional agenda item, I'm going to be proposing to this committee that regardless of whether this report is for us to consider or not, and even given the fact that it is the prerogative of the Speaker of Parliament to refer any report or any bill or anything to a relevant portfolio committee or even establish an ad hoc committee for that purpose, perhaps as this committee, we should be seen out there to be expressing ourselves on something like that, or at least possibly sensitizing the Speaker's office to say we are aware that there is such a report. It was tabled late in the day in the last parliament. We recommend that the Speaker expedite the referral of the committee to an appropriate structure of Parliament to deal with it accordingly. We're not necessarily saying it should come to us, and we're not necessarily telling the Speaker what to do, but we're merely saying that the Auditor General has issued a report, it's out in the public anyway. It would be good if Parliament expedited the processes of referring that report accordingly. And linked to this is the whole issue of, I want you to give me an assessment of Parliament institutional arrangements necessary to carry forward the product of your work. You have scope, you have us, you have what else? Your portfolio committee. I, for example, as a chairperson of the first thing I did when I became a chairperson, like 2 years ago, was to take a decision that, as a matter of course, whenever we consider the annual report of our department, we will, as a matter of course, invite the Auditor General's office to be present. Even if you have issued a clean report on the department, and actually invite you to interject and comment at any point on any issues relating to system finances of the department. Because we complain every day here in Poland that we don't have the capacity, we don't have the level of researchers. We're not endowed with your 700 accountants who can probe into this department. So the only capacity we really have when it comes to exercising oversight in the true sense of the word on department is actually use you as our instrument. But to what extent beyond scope? I mean, even scope itself, it has hundreds of committees to deal with, your reports to deal with. To what extent can they really sit on a department and pursue the issues that you have raised? I haven't really felt a very intimate interactive relationship between a portfolio committee and the AG's office. And my feeling is that if there's one contribution which this committee could make, it's to pursue that issue vigorously, to say no report of a portfolio committee should be adequate for consideration by the House if that report does not state that, one, the portfolio committee, in considering the annual report of the department, has also, on the same breath, considered the AG's report and any recommendations contained therein, engaged the department, preferably in the presence of the AG's. You know, because that way we can then begin to say we're taking our oversight role more seriously. And then the next issue I want to raise relates to your relationship as a constitutional independent entity and the other independent constitutional entity. You alluded, if I'm not wrong, to the PSC, the Public Service Commission. Certainly in the report that you've given us here, you do allude to the relations there, because naturally some of the transgressions there fall within the purview of Public Service Commission. What is the relationship? I have raised the question in Parliament. On the same breath as we should consider the Auditor General's report specifically, shouldn't we also, because my understanding is that the PSC also issues regular reports that do an evaluation of the public entity, shouldn't those reports be dealt with specifically and portfolio committees be compelled to look at the recommendations of those reports as well? And possibly invite the Public Service Commission as well to portfolio committees when they are exercising oversight on the department. So your relationship with the Public Service Commission, and of course it extends to other, or rather to civil law enforcement agencies, the Public Protector, for example, who has a similar role to play in relation to ensuring progress in the Then you have the role of this committee, vis-à-vis the specific mandate of ensuring your independence. It's a fairly new committee, so there's a lot of learning. When I asked somebody who worked with this committee in the previous parliament to give me a sense of what this committee is all about, I said, no, don't worry. You probably would be meeting twice or three times a year. There's very little work there to do. And all you need to do is to finalize some tariffs that the AG should be charging to entities that they do work to. So I came here with a sense that all we'll be coming to do is just to finalize some tariff or something. But as I met with the AG before this meeting, I got a sense that there is a lot that this committee can do, needs to do. We're entering a season of putting more emphasis on service delivery rather than on creating policy after another, and then dragging our feet when it comes to implementation, possibly because we hardly understood ourselves when we were writing in some of the things in the policy as to what we really meant. But anyway, so I think that we do need to get a clear sense of how do you see our role in supporting you in some specific terms. Have you encountered difficulties of non-compliance, resistance, being ignored, undermined in some way or the other? And how do you see us? I assume that the executive, the shared responsibility, the executive I'm sure has another responsibility in its own right to actually ensure that your work carries through. But we are here to speak on behalf of Parliament. We can only relate to this thing from a Parliament point of view. How do you see it? Let me leave it at that for now. I don't know. Are colleagues wanting to follow up on some of the issues I raised or to make some of the points?
The lot of points you raised about capacity building within the entity. There's no doubt what is coming through our report points to some of the issues that we highlighted here. And it's got to do with our assessment of the financial management skills and capacity among other things within entities in general. The one area that we get involved with, obviously, is a very big area, the required of us to audit and report. And that's the minimum. And we don't have audit and report. Once we issue the report, we come to the point about what our role is beyond just putting in a report. Because typically, in an audit environment, an auditor will issue a report and they will see to whether which is in the report has been dealt with the following year. Now, earlier when I indicated that the AG is around going to the roadshows and doing the door-to-door into the municipalities, it is exactly that input that we are seeing into the report. To say that it is not enough for us to issue a report that says that all these opinions are there. They are the stuff that is not desirable and leave it there. We actually take those reports and analyze them and go through an identification of what are the root causes that give rise to these undesirable outcomes. And then we engage with the key decision makers. For example, the point I made earlier about the provincial roadshows that we are doing. The AG is going currently as we speak, and it's one of these things that we say is actually one of the flagship programs, I think, that comes from the office. We go out to the municipalities in the province and meet with, let's say, the executive mayor, the municipal manager, and the CFO, and say, this is the outcome of your audit in the province. These are the driving forces or the issues that have contributed to this measure. We suggest, among others, that you consider putting in place an action plan that will potentially deal with the challenges that we have coming, financial reporting and financial management. Now that is the contribution in addition to what issue we have for. So that the following year, once that action plan has been approved, we cascade it. Once we do it in the municipality, we then take a view about the province itself. And at the provincial level, we would engage with the premier and the minister responsible for local government in the province, so that they themselves can also add what actions they are going to take to deal with the issues that are within their purview as relatives in that province. And the follow-up for the following year, when we start the audit of the following year, the starting point is then to go back to the commitments that they made when we went around the roadshow with them, and start there and say, before we even look at the current year that we are doing now, let's start with what is it that you have done to address the issues that we highlighted in the previous report. Now that's persuasion predominantly, Chair, because we do not really have the power to increase that demand, but we are actually trying to highlight to them that some of the issues that are coming out of this audit report are not extremely difficult. There are things that need people who don't even have financial management training, among others, to make sure that they are constantly on the lookout for things like, why is it taking you 6 months and longer to find an appropriate CFO for the state of municipality? Why is the audit committee not highlighting some of the issues that end up coming through the audit report? So those are the kind of things that we are highlighting to them, so that they can begin to understand that the audits that we do have got a direct bearing on them, even if they are not financially trained. And that's the kind of input that it is. However, the other point I think is related to this, which is about what do we do when all of these reports are issued. In the report that was tabled by Professor Kada Asman in the previous parliament, one of the key recommendations that came out, or one of the key observations that came out in that report, was to do with the fact that there is normally no consideration given to recommendations that are made by the Office of the AG. That was categorically stated as one of the key weaknesses that was identified when that review was done on the chapter 9. And I guess we would wait to see what will happen to the specific recommendation around what needs to happen with that particular item that was identified. So I think there is general...
I can already tell you that I understand that to be squarely within our mandate in relation to the protection and everything else that goes with that today, of the independence of the ages. So we will come to that point.
Right, so that's the issue around the capacity building. And I guess a lot of it then is in the hands of the executives. They are the ones who then need to put in place the right skills in the right places to make sure that from an audit point of view there are no challenges. But we do add our piece as well, as I said, in terms of the work that we do to analyze the detail of what's contained in our report. Regarding the institutional arrangement within Parliament and our assessment of the effectiveness of what is in place, certainly as far as scope is concerned, that's probably one policy up to most recently that we've been engaging directly because of the nature of the product that we bring on the table. However, at the end of the third Parliament, one of the recommendations that we made when we engaged with the chair of chairs between the NCOP and the National Assembly, Thomas Lennon of the Smart Parliament, was the specific recommendation that we highlighted to say that a lot of the things that come out in the department, you find them being handled by portfolio committees separately and with a different focus. But some of those things also come up in the audit report, but they also get handled directly by SCOPA with a different focus, which is about financial oversight. But there are links between the two. And one of the recommendations that we made when we engaged in that session was to say there needs to be found a mechanism where what comes through scope also gets through to the portfolio committee, so that can be closed. Maybe that's probably one of the things that we identified from our side as a gap that needs to be closed, to make sure that there's a close collaboration between issues that are handled within scope and portfolio committee.
I'll tell you, my experience has been that very often SCOPA would invite a representation of a portfolio committee when they consider an audit of that particular department. But given the nature of the program of Parliament, I don't recall ever having the opportunity to attend a SCOPA meeting. I don't even know, I haven't had first experience of a SCOPA engagement in the 10 years that I've been here. It's a way of confession. So I think we need to find another way. I don't know how, but where, you know, the portfolio committee perhaps would, in considering the report, have the benefit not only of the audit agency's report, but also of COPA's findings in relation or in deliver and engagement in relation to that. Maybe that's something we may need to beef up in relation to the whole issue of ages of it and portfolio committees.
And then with regards to our relationship with other chapter 9 institutions, we have currently with the Office of the Public Service Commission and a memorandum of understanding which we signed, and the basis for it was to say in some situations, for example, the Office of the PSC would do work around things like conflict of interest. On the other hand, we would also be doing similar work in the same environment. And really what we then started to try to build around is to say, let us cooperate much more closely around your program. Let us see what we're going to do, we'll show you what we're also going to do with regards to issues of performance review and performance assessment. So that mechanism is in place with the Office of the Public Service Commission. I recorded out there that there's a lot that is common between the staff that we might do, especially around performance review. We are also in the process of finalizing a similar MOU with the public protector. In fact, it's probably going to be kind of in the next month or so. And that's also an attempt to try and bring us closer to the kind of stuff that we're doing. There's already work that we are doing jointly on an assignment that is currently work in progress. So there is a level of engagement between some of those southern institutions that have a direct bearing on the work that we do. Certainly not all of them, but
Yeah.
Maybe those that we've identified, we are engaged in.
And law enforcement agency, prosecution authority, SAC.
We have not got to that level,
Perhaps you could answer it in the context that say of the question I asked that say that nature of because my understanding of PFMA is that it does not only have civil kind of remedies such as possible recovery of misappropriate funds and so on, but certain conduct criminally attract criminal liability. How do you ensure, once you may find it, and certainly from this report, I would assume there's a lot of heads that are going to go, because some of the things that are being referred to seem to border on criminality. So how do you systematically carry those issues forward?
On
up to Parliament, executive.
On our side, as I said, if one looks at our mandate is to audit and report.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And the evaluation of what is contained in our report is then in the hands of, for example, the executive authority to interpret what we put in the report based on the facts that we put in the report. and they must then decide what course of action they want to take. We're not empowered to pursue it beyond the report once we report it.
How would you understand the role of Parliament now that you report to Parliament? Obviously, to go find the House, how would you expect Parliament to ensure that the executive is carried through? Or is it linked to this other issue of recommendations of SCOPA being made and not being followed on from the Kada Asma report observation?
Yeah, it's linked to that, so that's what I think. If I can just put it a different way as well. We issue a report, the little we can do is to persuade somebody to do something about it, particularly where they are fed. Beyond that, in terms of what action then arises from that, is already in the hands of either Parliament or the executive arm of Parliament.
Maybe at some point, and this is where I'm going to rest my case in so far as this aspect of our engagement is concerned, maybe at some point this committee may request the Auditor General to give it a report on this issue, where the Auditor General is able to say clearly that I have reported situations and very little has been done. So that in us pursuing our role of ensuring your independence, your effectiveness, we can begin to look at a report which gives evidence of this kind of thing could render your function ineffective because there is no follow up. So that we can do our own work of ensuring that there is follow up, you know. Whatever it is that we do, whether it's tabling a report to the House or whatever it is, making recommendations arising from this committee to ensure that the Office of the General, is actually taken seriously. But let me not preempt things that are going to possibly be in the pipeline when it's just throwing feelers around. But as time progresses, I think we'll begin to consolidate and concretize some of these things and cut out teeth for ourselves, so to speak.
I'm going to add just one point to it. on the matter of the role of SCOEC, protecting the office and supporting the office.
Yeah.
A lot of the things that we've been looking at, among others, if you look at the different categories of audit reports that we've issued, you'll find that there's a clean audit, a qualified audit, an adverse one, and a disclaimer. One of the things we've been looking at within the context of the ones where we are not able to express an opinion because we didn't get access to the information that we need. And one of the things that we've been looking at was to start doing an analysis of what these disclaimer of opinion for this outcome are about. Because either the information that we are supposed to have access to is not being made available to us for whatever reason. And for as long as if that opinion is issued and nothing happens, it will perpetuate itself over a number of years, because then the disclaimed opinion
will just continue.
It will continue and it will probably over time have the same status as a clean audit.
Right.
Because for a clean audit, it's a second the best, it's done well, but for a disclaimed opinion, it's something close to that as well, because nothing happens. So I think it's important in the context of the point that you made in terms of the direction that the committee would like to take. To also start maybe looking at a report that analyzes what gives rise to this. Is this information deliberately suppressed, or is this information that was never there in the first instance when transaction took place?
I think those categories that you have given are going to necessarily also inform the kind of punitive measures that can be meted out in each instance. Because there has to be some kind of hierarchy in terms of the gravity of the offense. I would imagine refusal to give access should just be a tangible as a lack of what shall we call it, probity or lack of or misappropriation of resources. So that people begin to take the importance of making information available as to what they did with public money just as important as using the public money for the right purpose. But I think we'll begin to look at those enforcement mechanisms and ask our question, what role should this committee play in ensuring that we have genuine enforcement tools that will ensure that the Auditor General's work does not go down the drain in vain. That's how I interpret one of the critical rules. Because SCOPA has been there, it's also reinforced the findings of the AG, been through the House and adopted and so on. But I'm not sure whether SCOPA itself has a role to play in terms of following on, ensuring that those recommendations they made have since been, I assume in subsequent reports, they in a recurring way would say, this department has never complied within the stipulated period that the resolution of the House stated, and that's where it will end. So we may have to look at what ongoing work should this committee be playing after SCOPA has done its work to ensure that ultimately there is compliance, whether it's about issuing regular reports to the Speaker to say, go pass a report on this, the House is resolved, still we are not seeing any progress. Can we get the Minister to come to the House and answer a question, for example, specifically in that regard? Not necessarily in the context of a SCOPA report, but in the context of previous reports that have not been acted upon. But anyway, all right, let's quickly, I don't know, we probably have exhausted time, and I think for a good reason, on this one, which may have left us very little time to do anything else. I need your guidance.
Yeah, sure, thank you very much. Just on the last one that the DEC made, on, you know, when we read this report that you push, that you present to us, you say qualified, unqualified, disclaimer, opinion, and things like that. Can you, in a document, unpack for us, for this committee, what do these things mean in your language? You know, so we have an understanding. I mean, a disclaimer, like you said, a disclaimer is where you don't get the information. Qualified audit opinion means you haven't got 10% of the kind of things that you want to do. So, you know, we'll have some understanding and then we can engage with you at the workshop so that we find each other on
in a sense, instruments that enable us to understand how you work.
It's part of that program, all of those things are part of that.
Just coming to that again, Chair, earlier on you mentioned the, we talk about the APAC workshop. Now, having the benefit of coming from SCOPA, there is a workshop planned for the 28th and 29th of July. Unless it's been moved from the last meeting, which I attended last week, but we confirmed it at the Parkstonian Hotel in Johannesburg for the Public Accounts Committee. And I don't know if this was going to slot in into that program there within the two days thing for the 28th and 29th.
Is it not the shift of date of the same thing?
No, separate.
Oh, it's completely separate things, but nothing to do with that one.
Are we involved in that one?
I don't know. Maybe you need to talk to them.
Because the program that I have has the date 5th and 6th, and then the 19th and the...
Yeah.
Okay. And the 20th of August. 30th of September.
So this
can somebody just contextualize that one? Yeah. Are we part of it in the first place?
The Association of Public Accounts Committees.
So they're having their own little thing.
Their own orientation.
Okay. Well,
that one focuses predominantly on quite a lot
SCOPA.
Of tasks that the committee has enabled. So that it enables
them
to separate.
You see, that's why we chose to have today.
Yeah.
Because besides, we can't wait for the system, the system's over. And it might as well that happens, because when the media approaches me after this meeting and asks what is this committee doing about this thing in the media, at least I should be able to say we're not with the AG. I had an initial introduction to him. And also, was there somebody else
who wanted coming back to the date, the 60th, the Thursday, so these workshops or the orientation programs, where do they take place? Do they take place in Parliament? Do they take place outside? Anybody can say, because the 60th is a corporate day in the morning, the Thursday. So, you know, we all have to attend the Thursday. Maybe Tuesday, Wednesday.
The orientation. But I'd like to also point out the first instance was a provisional date. This date was set down at the stage at the beginning of our year when we had no idea what, you know, who would be there, etc., and when they would be coming to action. So the date can be shifted as per your requirement.
Well, it can possibly be just out because with the number of other entities that have a role in it as well. Such as what do you call them? The association of and the executive so I think we'll fit in with probably the smallest in terms of numbers, so we'll probably fit in with the majority.
I think it's the meeting of this committee only, with yours.
No, the fifth and the sixth phase, if you look at the
the executive, your executive.
I thought it's government. Oh,
no.
So basically it's APEC and us, and yourself.
In fact, the fifth and the sixth is an orientation program for all the SCOAS members. For example, I don't know how many there are, 12 persons.
Oh, is it just us, and yourself?
Yeah.
Oh, so APEC, why do I say APEC?
APEC is a different one. APEC is the one that's happening at the end of July.
Yeah, because this one was saying combined. So the understanding is that you will have one with APEC, and then you'll have one with us separately.
Yes.
And we'll have a full 2-day workshop to run through. Alright. Now that's fine. Then you are also saying to us that therefore there is some flexibility around. I would prefer to bring it forward. The sooner we are fully conversant with the full extent of our mandate, the better. I would rather not postpone it for another 2 months, because after the 100 years of 100 days of our existence, we won't be able to report to the president. If he has to assess us, some of us might lose our job too.
The only thing here, the problem we're going to have.
Yeah.
We're going to go from now until about the end of July with committee, with this extended committee's budget, and then we reset on about the 7th or 8th of July until the 31st of July for constituency work. So it means we can only have it early August.
And also the challenge on our part, just is that as we get into July, our availability will become a challenge to the end of July.
Yeah.
When most of the theater makers work again. I think the services who are supposed to deliver the material will be
preoccupied. So basically, you're saying the July month we set our next year to
comply? Yes,
but if we agree on the percentage chair, you've got to get permission from the chair of committee. And the committee
will
be
the
absent for the 2 days.
Yeah. Now, in that event, it probably becomes a cost to Parliament, because this is our work of this committee. I don't know. And we could even push that we be taken out of this space.
Yeah. Yeah.
We can't think clearly in this corridor.
I demand to
have
this.
Yes.
This and this of us will be back. Because
yes.
I understand we'll be back.
Yes.
Not that we'll be back on the continent.
You mean in terms of research?
Yeah, in terms of research.
In terms of research.
Yeah,
in the 31st July.
No,
that will be the end of.
Can you check with the relevant powers that
existing?
Yeah, but also in terms of this thing being outside of. Where we can think clearly, preferably with the smell of the sea close. Wherever the place will be. So that people don't move in and out of offices and other committees and so on. You know that you are locked there and you can't go to your very important.
On a wine farm somewhere.
Yeah, even if you wish. It's too far, there is no public transport to get to Parliament. You know? Yeah, it would be in Cape Town, because that would avoid life cost. All right. Colleagues, look, we can't deal with the other agenda items here. We will do our own homework in the meantime to find out from Parliament exactly how this committee is to be funded in terms of our activities, because, and then to zoom into our program, because one of the questions we may need to ask is that if we have to exercise oversight on the AG's office, precisely for some of the questions that members have raised this morning around contracting capacity, human resources, maybe we may want to go and visit some of the offices of the AG and get to see what's happening there, you know? And see whether, in fact, you said 2,000 people working for you. Audit the auditor general. Anyway, so we may want to do that kind of oversight, and possibly also visit your satellite provinces, because the other issue is it's relating to another issue which we're discussing elsewhere around the separation of powers between the three spheres of government. My understanding is that the AG's office is an exclusive national competence, that there are no provincial auditor general. There's only one national auditor general. And the location of satellite offices in provinces does not detract from that. So if that be so, it means that our mandate extends to the provincial presence of the Auditor General's office, in the sense that we may want even to go and visit some of those satellite offices at provincial level and see what's happening there. But I thought I should just mention that. I know the audit committee is here, and we were also hoping to have Remco. What do we do? What's the time now? Okay. I'd hope that we could run between 10 and 12, it's after 12. Should we perhaps defer that input to the workshop?
Yeah.
Because that's probably going to be focusing on some of the detailed work that you actually do, which might not be appropriate on day one. Already we have sufficient bombardment of valuable information. Is there somebody who wants to propose the last item? It's not appearing on the agenda. All right, can I just...
But in chair,
yeah.
If I may, I'll certainly do my best. I'll need to check my diary, subject to any appointments not being that I can't rearrange. I'll certainly be able to attend on the before the sit. There is just one issue that I want to highlight, which is of paramount importance.
Let me do this. Let me give you 5 minutes. You represent the audit committee. Let me give you a fastener, so don't rush the issue. Then you can make the second and the third issue point.
Chair, well, first of all, thanks for extending the invitation to the Audit Committee, to a very good standing committee, and also appreciate your proactive approach in setting up this meeting prior to the 7-6 session. As the BAG said, Peter Moyer is the chairman. He apologizes he couldn't make it, and I was asked to stand in for him. The key issue that I think the committee needs to be aware of right now is right near the back of this presentation, one of the challenges facing the office at the moment, and that is the Auditor General appoints external auditors, or more precisely, the Standing Committee approves the appointment of external auditors. The current firm doing that audit is BDO St. Stuart, who into their 10th year, and they need to rotate off the audit. They're doing the current audit, which their report will be finalized by the...
Auditing the Auditor General.
And their term of office comes to an end. The Auditor General, working through the Audit Committee, has an approved, or has a plan to find a replacement firm. That plan was presented to the previous Parliament Standing Committee, which at the end was chaired by Mr. Vincent Smith, and they gave approval in principle, but they didn't feel it was appropriate for them to set it in concrete, given that there was a new committee that would be taking office. But in terms of that approval in principle, the office has placed an advertisement in the Sunday Times calling for firms to tender for the audit of the Audit General. The Audit Committee will be involved in that process, and we will be putting a recommendation up to the Standing Committee. It's very important that is addressed as a key issue. Otherwise, the Auditor General is going to find themselves in the untenable situation where they won't have an auditor. So I just want to place that on the table, and I think the AG or the DAG or one of the executives will probably engage with yourself as chairman of the Standing Committee on that issue. To make sure that it gets addressed as a matter of priority. The rest of my...
Would prerogative is it Parliament's decision, is Parliament's call, or is the AG's call? How does it, what is the role?
My understanding, subject to correction by the DAG, is that this Standing Committee, the Auditor General has a government department, and they initiate the process. But it's very important that the independence of the external auditors is preserved. So the actual decision is removed from the Auditor General's office. We as the Audit Committee, which is, we all independent non-executives, get involved in that process, and we put up the formal proposal to your committee, but your committee will make the decision as to who the external auditors are.
Look, I mean, this committee should, in principle, be available 4 days a week, every week of Parliament sitting. So if there is specific business that it can be involved with, it certainly will convene to do that business. So if the proposal is that we should schedule a meeting to formally consider any such matter, then we should be informed accordingly and make the necessary application to Parliament to be granted an permission to sit. If the referral of the matter has to go via the Speaker's office, that should also be clarified so that the necessary processes are followed accordingly, so that the committee is duly constituted and it's sitting in considering the matter, because we wouldn't want to flout the processes as they should be. All right?
Yeah,
so that should cover it. All right, and finally, there's this report issue. We don't. Do we have copies? Look.
No,
okay, this is something that's come up. This was given to me this morning following discussions with officials in the AG's office yesterday. But I just forgot, I could have at the beginning of the meeting checked, because we there are copies. Let me just indicate. This report is a special report that was produced by the AG and was tabled before Parliament on the 20th of April, I understand, this year, 2 days before election. So naturally, Parliament was not in a position to in any way deal with this. We have resumed a month or two ago as a new Parliament. My understanding is that reports of this nature and similar instruments, upon being tabled before Parliament, it's the prerogative of the Speaker to refer such a report to an appropriate committee. Right? Now, it appears as if this report has not yet been referred, and there have been numerous articles in the media over the weekend questioning whether Parliament is acting on this. Now, I indicated some of the media people that, look, this committee is going to sit today, and that will be the first opportunity we ever get to meet on the committee. And I think that perhaps the best we can do as a committee, if there's agreement, I know we all haven't looked at it. I've only received it this morning. I haven't read it, but possibly to say that in line with our own mandate, we want to advise Parliament to expedite the referral of a report to an appropriate committee of Parliament to consider, so that we are seen as a committee, not to be folding our arms when issues of personal importance that relate to our area of work come up, and we, you know, we simply keep silent and say nothing about it.
Yeah, I think we must not deal with the details is for another committee.
Yeah.
But can I just find out through you who commissioned this particular report?
Well, maybe let's ask that.
Because then we could make a statement, our chairman could make a statement.
Mm.
Well, was it something that the office of the AG decided to, and itself, no one undertake this?
Maybe the report does say.
Was it commissioned by whoever?
Chair, I think the best for us to get an answer. This report that we appreciate has been in the environment, basically, the weather has been over a period of time.
Yeah.
And personally, on my side, I didn't check. I don't know if it's specifically, because I'm not sure about the time. I can keep in touch on that one and then come back to the chair or provide an answer. I don't know for sure.
I think, Chair, that would be good, because the kind of statement that the Chair can make is that, you know, the independence of the Office of the Auditor General is hereby confirmed by the production of this report here.
Mm-hmm.
And we are here as a committee, I mean, at our first meeting, to protect the independence and integrity of the Office of the Auditor General.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the kind of statement I think our Chair can put out.
I can certainly try and provide a specific answer to that. Because there were specific people that were involved in this process, but the person ultimately who had to drive the communication of the outcome of what was in the report prior to this meeting or what the agency had. So I can just double check with him together with the people who were driving the transformation of the report.
I just want the secretary to read the first two paragraphs of this report, just to give a quick background to me.
The Auditor General issued a report to Parliament in January 2006 regarding approval for government employees to perform other remunerative work and the disclosure of financial interests by ministers, deputy ministers, and managers. This report indicated that designated employees, in brackets senior managers and certain ministers, failed to disclose their interests, and that the majority of government employees did not have approval to perform remunerated work outside their employment in government, as prescribed by the relevant legislation and regulation.
And then continue the second paragraph.
the second paragraph says, based on the above, a transversal performance audit was conducted on government employee-related entities doing business with national and provincial departments. This report only focused on government employee-related entities doing business with national departments. This report was compiled after the audit at provincial level was completed during the period August 2007 and July 2008.
So that is in essence the background and the context in which this report arises. But let's make sure that immediately after this meeting, every member of this committee has a copy of this report in the prison hall. I understand that when you table reports, some 500 copies get made available in the store, so there should be sufficient at least as a matter of urgency. And I think you would recall those who were here before, and people who were not even in Parliament, back in 2006, when this other report is being mentioned, there was a whole thing about, for example, some ministers having been on boards of charities even. And because, you know, something about companies, even if you've tendered a letter of resignation to the new board, that you're no longer a member, you have nothing to do with that company, that is not adequate to remove your name from that paper. You still have to fill some form, I think it's called CM21 or something, with the register of company before your name can come up. So members, be careful with your declaration of financial interest. You may be thinking that, oh, that charity, I left it 10 years ago, I have nothing to do with it, and your name is going to come up.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so I think if that is the understanding, will this possibly respond to the media queries?
By complimenting the Office of the Auditor General for the support, and also I think, Chair, there's some provinces that haven't completed the investigation in KwaZulu-Natal and a few other provinces, and we would like the Office of the Auditor to expedite that process.
Yeah. All right, we'll try and see if we can't craft some broad statement around that. And possibly write a letter to the speaker, you know, urging that this thing be expedited. All right, colleagues, on that note, you end your salaries for the day. You can go home.